from KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. After 26 years of incarceration for a crime he did not commit, Lacino Hamilton was exonerated and released from prison in September 2020. Writing about his experience for Truth Out, he explained the pain of his incarceration, the scourge of the pandemic behind bars, and more. Today, as Democratic Party politicians pay lip service to racial justice and reforming the criminal justice system, we speak with Mr. Hamilton about his views on whether the U.S. has indeed entered a new era. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So first, Lacino, before we get to your views on Biden, how do you explain your situation, your case, and why you were incarcerated and eventually exonerated? If you can give our audience that brief story, which you've written about in Truth Out.
In July of 1994, my foster mother of over 15 years from my childhood into my young adulthood was murdered. I was arrested for a unrelated crime and was framed by the police. The police manufactured a witness. I was taken to trial based solely on the alleged confession to a jailhouse informant, and was essentially railroaded by the system and convicted for a crime I didn't commit, where there was no evidence or anything to say I did anything.
And so you spent 26 years behind bars. This was, I understand, in Michigan?
Yes, ma'am. So I filed appeals, several appeals. And we were just being ignored. You know, there was overwhelming evidence that was found to show what had happened. You know, memorandums that were wrote between the prosecutor's office and some of the high command in the police department, where they were laying out how the frame up happened, the particular men who were a part of the frame up. There were court records that were suppressed that was eventually found, where illegal deals were given to these men. It was a tremendous amount of evidence that was presented to the courts, and the courts basically just turned a blind eye to it.
And then in September of last year, you were eventually, finally freed. What did it take to free you?
The state of Michigan started its first conviction integrity unit, where the unit looks at old cases where there is a possibility of wrongful conviction or some sort of wrongdoing. Our Wayne County prosecutor, Kim Worthy, made a courageous decision and appointed Valerie Newman, a longtime freedom fighter, a longtime defender for the truth and justice in the courts. And her unit took a real look at the case. There were several innocent projects over the years that had my case, believed in the case, worked the case, but never quite had enough. And when the conviction integrity unit took the case, they found evidence that had been suppressed, DNA evidence in particular. And once the DNA evidence was tested and was proven not to be mine, that was the piece of evidence we had always needed.
In Truth Out, you wrote about the horrors of incarceration. We'll link to your Truth Out page from our website as well, and people can certainly go to truthout.org and search by your name, Lacino Hamilton. But you talked about the way in which you... One piece was entitled, "I Am Buried Alive in a Michigan Prison." That was in April 2018, November of that same year. "I've been in prison for 24 years and I feel dead." Can you explain for me, and especially for our audience who may not have had, those among our audience who may not have had direct experience with our system of incarceration, when you hear politicians talking about reforming our incarceration system and the fact that we just have far too much mass incarceration, do they even really understand the human cost of our current existing status quo?
I have to say, I believe they do. I believe they do because there is a tremendous amount of research, a tremendous amount of evidence of the emotional, the psychological horrors of being incarcerated. There's a pantheon of writings from incarcerated men and women themselves where they have explained and detailed the daily lives of someone who's been shrunk down and tried to fit in that inhuman space. So there's no doubt in my mind that politicians are aware.
There's been a lot of emphasis on the federal prison system, and in particular, the federal private prison system, the fact that the U.S. government contracts with private companies. When he was president, Barack Obama actually toured private prison, and now Joe Biden has talked about ending contracts with private prisons. What do you make of this? Is this a start? Is this not enough?
It's nowhere near a start. So here in Michigan has no private prisons such as we have any private companies that own or operate or run a prison. Yet the entire Michigan penal system is privatized. And what I mean is, even though they are state correctional facilities, Michigan has privatized all the services. So the phones, the healthcare, the dental, the food services, the commissary, you name it, every part of the prison system has some sort of private interest. So with the president just saying that there will be no private companies running the business, here in Michigan, we don't have that, but yet our system is privatized.
And I should mention on this, as an aside, President Biden's ban on new private prison contracts does not include those that are being used to hold immigrants, who are detained immigrants. So ICE detainees will continue to be imprisoned in private prisons, and the federal government apparently plans to sign new contracts with them. We, of course, over the past year have been dealing society-wide with this horrific pandemic. There's been not enough media coverage of how that pandemic has unfolded behind bars in spaces where people are forced to be in each other's space. The warehousing of human beings does not do well when we have a pandemic. Tell me about your experience, because you were imprisoned up until September of last year.
It was a horrible experience. There's just 2 or 3 days ago, a friend of mine passed away from the coronavirus.
I'm so sorry.
In prison at the Macomb Correctional Facility. And my time while I was there, maybe in about a 5 or 6 month time span, up to about maybe close to a dozen or maybe a little under prisoners died. In prison, there's just no way to social distance. On top of the lack of care and the lack of things needed to even deal with a pandemic. It's just a horrible situation there.
So that continues, of course. And as we are now in the phase where vaccines are being rolled out, I understand that there is no real plan, at least at the federal level, for vaccines to be given to those who are incarcerated. At the state levels, I believe it sort of varies state by state. But you would imagine that those people who do not have the ability, because the state has deemed it so, to socially distance from one another, that at least vaccines would be a priority. But we're not seeing that, are we?
No, we're not seeing that at all here in Michigan. Not only just a vaccine, in Michigan, there really is no care. If someone becomes ill from the coronavirus, they're simply just sat in the gym. They're just bunk beds and sat in the gym, and they'll come take the temperatures. But as far as health care or medicine or treatment, that's only if they're at the most critical stages. But other than that, there is no sort of care.
Right, and you wrote about this. They were warehousing incarcerated people who caught the virus in the prison gymnasium for, I guess, weeks upon weeks with other people who also had been infected. I imagine that they probably didn't receive top-notch care.
No, and it's not because of the coronavirus. It's just in prison in general. Mm-hmm. As I alluded to earlier,
yeah.
The Michigan healthcare system has been privatized. And with the privatization of the Michigan healthcare system, many of the services have been cut out. And so healthcare in the Michigan prisons, coronavirus or not, is subpar and inhuman.
How important was it for you while you were incarcerated to be able to speak out, to be able to have this voice, the space to write in an outlet like truthout.org and make yourself heard? Did you feel that the majority of incarcerated people simply do not have that voice?
Oh, without a doubt, very few people. And even myself, there was a tremendous price to pay for me writing those articles and sharing with the world what myself and others were experiencing while we're in prison. So a lot of people know that I are hearing or becoming aware that I did 26 years in prison, but I also did 9 years in the hole. I did 11 years in maximum security, and I was repeatedly classified as a security threat, which is the prison's way of calling you a terrorist. And all of that was in response to my writing and my activism while I was in prison.
So you paid a price for speaking out by being put into solitary confinement.
Yes, ma'am.
And of course, that is a whole different level of incarceration, which you've also written about, the horrors of which, we only know because people like yourself have been speaking out about them. I recall a few years ago when there were protests and hunger strikes in various prisons around the country against the torture, which is basically what it is, of solitary confinement. And there was some lip service being paid to improving that. But do you feel that over and over we just see our political leaders admit that our system of incarceration is so broken and just not do enough about it?
Yes. I mean, I think we would be remiss if we didn't spend some time here to talk about reform and how we've always had reform and to acknowledge what's actually happening. So a lot of people are applauding the reforms and that are happening. And I applaud anything that gets anyone out of prison. But I think we need to step back for a second. You know, it may be hard for some people to wrap their minds around this, but incarceration that we've known for the last half a century has come to an end. You know, warehousing men and women in large numbers, isolated in some sort of physical structure or dungeon is over with. We're moving into an age of e-carceration. We're moving into an age where technology will be used to incarcerate people. So some of the reforms that look like they're good, they're only necessary because a lot of the physical structures and things that we use will no longer be needed. And I was with a young woman a couple of days ago that I was working with, and I noticed that she had a ankle monitor on. And I asked her about it. And she said, no, it's not that kind of ankle monitor. It's the kind of ankle monitor that if I walk within a certain range of my victim, it tells me restricted zone, remove yourself, and immediately call your parole agent. That is the era that we're moving into. And so these reforms should not be looked at as some sort of real victory.
When you were still incarcerated last year, in addition to dealing with a pandemic within the prison system, I imagine that you were watching the Black Lives Matter protests unfold outside. Tell me what that was like and how you viewed the incredible, the overwhelming support that we saw from most sectors of society for the simple idea that Black people should be treated equally to others, and that horrific killing of George Floyd, then the videotape of his killing that sparked that nationwide movement and even international movement?
It was exciting and it was exhilarating for myself and a lot of the men and women in prison, especially when the attention was put on the prisons. A lot of people move throughout their day-to-day lives and might not realize that there's a prison a few miles outside of town or, and so it's great when the attention that was put on it. But we also know that we marched before, you know, we've had mass protests before, and we still seem to be at that same point that we've always been at. So while it's exciting, you know, we were in there thinking, you know, what more could we do? You know, there has to be something more that we can do than just march in the slogans that I believe most people know, whether they admit it or not.
And then, of course, we saw the tide shift, especially among white Americans, where once there was enough negative coverage by Fox News, et cetera, that the popularity of that rallying cry, that cry of Black Lives Matter, that slogan started to go down. And then just a few weeks ago, we saw a violent mob that claimed it was all about law and order essentially undermine the very seat of American democracy. What do you make of everything that unfolded with the Capitol riot and the fact that there weren't very many arrests on the day of the riot? People pointed out the hypocrisy of, you know, had those been Black Lives Matter protesters, they would have been pepper sprayed, gunned down, arrested, hauled away. To date, only 170 people have been charged.
I think all the things that you said are the obvious. You know, when I watched that sad display on TV, I seen a bunch of poor people and a bunch of frustrated people. I seen people who don't have the answers to their problems and people who are being misled.
But there were also people who traveled there on private jets.
there definitely were those people there instigating it. But I'm saying the majority of the people who make up the Trumpsters or those, a lot of those people are suffering. They don't have the answers. A lot of those people are being misled or to believe that other people who are suffering are their problems when it's not.
I want to ask you about the idea of abolishing. You know, we've talked about when Black Lives Matter really became popular over the past summer, a very important demand was to defund the police, a sort of related and longer standing demand by people who call themselves prison abolitionists has been to abolish prisons. Do you see those two demands as being linked to one another? And how do you respond to those who say, well, that's just too radical?
I want to deal with the latter question about those who say it's too radical, right? In any situation in life where someone is being harmed, for an example, maybe a woman who's in a relationship, in an abusive relationship, people who would assist would probably advise her to leave that situation immediately. You know, even if she asked, where would I sleep? What would I eat? What I do for clothes? They would probably understand that all of those things we'll deal with later. But right now we have to remove you from that situation. We also have those things when it comes to maybe like child welfare. When a child is in danger and harm, and when people come to that house, they will remove that child with no idea whatsoever the long term for that child. They just know right now we have to remove that child. And it's like that in a lot of situations until it comes to prison. We know that men and women are being harmed in there. We know that they're emotionally, psychologically being harmed. We know what it does to the family. We know what it does to the community. Yet when it's time to say, let's immediately remove people from that situation, we somehow have a problem with it. In any situation where someone is being harmed, no one can sit there and honestly and say, well, we're going to allow that person to continue to be harmed. Abolition is the most logical thing that I can think of for a system that, without a doubt, that we know does harm on a scale that we can't even begin to measure.
Well, Lacino, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time. We'll post a link to your Truth Out page where people can read your writings. Good luck to you.
Thank you, ma'am.
My guest has been Lacino Hamilton. He's a writer, thinker, and activist who was wrongfully convicted and incarcerated for 26 years. He was eventually exonerated and freed in September 2020. He writes for truthout.org. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.